We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming in a multi-talented performer, singer, songwriter, producer, arranger, actor, author, music historian, and more. Here's a little taste of his newest album, Timeless.
I see you trying to hide down deep inside your shell. I see that look in your eyes. It's one that I know well.
We're pleased to welcome to the program the very talented Billy Vera. Billy, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rich.
You know, my grandmother used to say to me when I had a lot of interest as a kid, she would wag her finger and say, "Jack of all trades, master of none." But you, sir, have found a way to master a whole lot of them through the years.
Well, I discovered about 25 years ago that, you know, in show business, is as my mother told me, it's a business of peaks and valleys. And I figured out that If you try and do everything that you're fairly good at, in any given year, one of them will be doing well.
You've got a new book out on the history of specialty records called Rip It Up, and I want to talk about that a little later. But also, a documentary is out based on your own memoir from a couple of years ago, Harlem to Hollywood, and I want to focus on that and some of your backstory that begins with you saying that you were born of fleeting romance, a difficult relationship between your parents. How did that shape you as a young guy?
Well, I think that's a question nobody's ever asked me in all the billions of interviews I've done. So that's refreshing. I think it made me kind of isolate and, you know, learning how to be a musician. You have to be, it's a lonely task. So being isolated anyway from my family, you know, gave me plenty of time to work on my music.
Your mom was a singer along the way, dated Frankie Lane, maybe Sinatra, and worked with the likes of Perry Como, your dad, a radio announcer, and you sort of followed his career from California East with an important stop in Cincinnati when he worked at, and they both worked at WLW, which was a legendary station that produced a lot of giants, one of them Rod Serling, who was there when your parents were working there.
Yeah, there were quite a few big stars that came out of WLW, you know, from Doris Day to Rosemary Clooney to Andy Williams to the Mills Brothers and on. It had 50,000 watts clear channel. And at one time, they had, before the government came down on them, they had as many as 500,000 watts.
Like a lot of people, you grew up listening to the music that your parents listened to. And is it right that your earliest musical memories were of the King Cole Trio?
Yeah. My mom brought home a song called The Frim Fram Sauce, which I was just, as a six-year-old, I was just crazy about that record, probably wore it out.
What led to your embrace and love of African-American arts and culture?
I don't know. It just appealed to me more than anything else that was out there, although I did like a lot of the pop, the white music. You know, my mom brought home Sinatra, too, and people like that. So, you know, I just had a very broad taste, but I did gravitate more towards black music, yeah.
You ended up moving with the family to New York and began working on music yourself and then would have your first songwriting success with a Ricky Nelson tune, but one that you didn't write for Rick Nelson.
No, there was this new girl singer that was had come out, and I really liked the sound of her records and her voice, and her name was Dionne Warwick, so I, not knowing that Burt Bacharach and Hal David had her all wrapped up, I just wrote this song for her, and the first publisher I ever took a song to, the guy took this song, and I said, "Can you get me that new girl singer you know, Dionne Warwick. And he said, well, I'll try. And a couple of weeks later, he called me back, and one morning he said, I got a record on your song. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, Ricky Nelson. I said, Ricky Nelson, he's white. He said, you ungrateful little putz. He said, Ricky's going to do your song 5 weeks in a row on the Ozzy and Harriet show, and you're going to make good money because everything that Ricky makes, you know, becomes a hit. So I you know, reconciled myself to that. And I'm, to this day, I'm real happy and proud of that record because in New York, you know, since Ricky was based in Los Angeles, not many New York songwriters got songs recorded by him.
These days, Billy, in the music business, things have changed so much, and ways of exposing music to potential listeners are very different. What was it like in those days in the early 60s in New York City? We think about the Billboard building, but it was much more than that. There were so many of these small publishing houses, and the opportunities for young people to get a chance seemed to be very different than what we see now.
Oh, absolutely. You know, a lot of these old guys that were running the business, you know, guys in their 40s, guys on their deathbed, They thought that anybody that was, you know, in their 20s must know something. So it was pretty easy to see people, to make appointments. And you know, you could write a song in the morning, hop on a train, and, you know, that afternoon play it for somebody and get, you know, a $35 advance or something like that. And go home and write another one for the next day. You know, so it was pretty easy. And there was two main buildings. The Brill Building that you mentioned, that was 1619 Broadway. And then just up the street was actually the Cooler Building, which was 1650 Broadway. And they had a lot of, you know, good publishers and record companies in there. And on the having a Ricky Nelson hit, that opened a lot of doors for me, too. You know, it was a cottage industry back then, and so, you know, if you had a hit record and you were a new kid on the block, it seems like everybody knew who you were, so they would listen to your songs. So I ended up with a very big publishing company, April Blackwood Music, which was owned by CBS and Columbia Records. So they gave me a little tiny office with a little tiny piano, and, you know, your boss would come in, knock on the door, and say, hey, the Drifters are recording next week. Write something for them. Or Tony Bennett's recording. So you learned how to write in all these different styles, and, you know, or you might have to write for a girl, so you had to put your mind in the how a young girl would think. You know, it was like being an actor almost. And, you know, sometimes you got lucky and you got your songs recorded.
We're talking with Billy Vera here on Downtown. How did you get together for the first time with Chip Taylor?
Well, he was already at that company, April Blackwood. He had a double job there. He was a staff songwriter and he was an executive there. And so the boss at April Blackwood said, listen, you know, you write good songs. He says, but you still need a little seasoning. I'm going to put you together with Chip Taylor, who, as it turned out, had gone to same high school as I went to. He was about 4 years older than me. And the first song we wrote together was called Make Me Belong to You, and it became a hit for Barbara Lewis that summer. And so that opened the door at Atlantic Records for us. And then we wrote another song that we thought might be a good duet for a couple of Atlantic artists. And we brought the song, we made a demo and brought the song to Jerry Wexler, who was the big honcho up there. And we played it for him, and he banged his fist on the desk and declared it a smash and said, listen, he said, get rid of the girl on the demo and I'll record you on Atlantic Records. Get another girl. So I was friendly with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells we had worked a lot with them. I had the house band at this club up on the in Westchester County on the border of Greenwich, Connecticut. It was like the hottest club in the area. And on weekends, we would have, we'd play a couple of dance sets, and we'd also back up two shows of a current hit record act, one on Friday and one on Saturday. And very often, Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells came up there. So one of the girls in the group, Nona Hendricks, had a deeper voice than Patti's, and I thought she'd blend better with me. So she and I went in and recorded this song. And they were already on Atlantic, so there was no contractual problems until their manager got in on the act, and he said, well, you know, if Billy and Nona have a hit, she might leave the group and blah, blah. And Patti said, no, no, that'd be great for us because we don't have a guitar player. And Billy could be our guitar player, and then Billy and Nona could do their hit, and we could do our hit. She'd get more money for the act. But the manager didn't see it that way. So we had to audition about 20 more girls. And we finally were just about to give up, and Jerry Wexler called up and said, listen, we just got this girl, Judy Clay. She's a cousin of Dionne Warwick, and she's a great singer. Why don't you take a listen to her? And we did, and she fit the bill. And we put her voice on the record, and we ended up with a hit record called Storybook Children.
Yeah, you sure did. The follow-up, A Country Girl, City Man, an even bigger hit, and it got you the opportunity to perform at the Apollo Theater. What was that like for you?
Well, that was a dream come true for me because I had gone to the Apollo as a customer a number of times. In fact, I was there when James Brown recorded that famous Live at the Apollo album. You know, my guitar player and I were the only white guys in the whole theater. And it was just the best show, to this day, best show I've ever seen in my life. So to be on the stage of that wonderful theater was, you know, just, I mean, I had two dreams. I wanted to be on American Bandstand, and I wanted to play the Apollo. So here, 23 years old, I got my first dream.
Also, we're talking about Chip Taylor. Because of that friendship, you ended up learning to be an actor. Because people may not know, Chip Taylor's brother is Academy Award-winning actor John Voight, and it was John Voight who talked you into taking an acting class.
That is true. That was many years later after I moved to California. But yeah, John used to come up to the office, and you know, he was just a brand new actor at that time, and we'd all, the three of us, would go have a sandwich at a local deli or something, and we, in fact, we used to go when he'd do a play or a movie. We'd, you know, Chip and I would go see it to support him, and then he made Midnight Cowboy, and boy, his career just took off after that.
You had a great band. That was it, the Knight Riders, back in New York.
Yeah, that was a really good little band. Yeah.
And there's a little connection to our show there because one of your band members was John Leventhal, who's now the husband of a great friend of our show, Roseanne Cash.
Yeah, well, Johnny was in my band, you know, some years after the Knight Riders. But, yeah, he was a wonderful guitar player. He was in the last band I had when I lived in New York. In the last maybe 3 years I lived there in the late 70s. Yeah, I loved his guitar playing.
How did you end up getting a number one song with Dolly Parton's recording of I Really Got the Feeling?
Well, this was, again, in the late 70s, and my career was in the toilet, you know, in the 70s. I just couldn't figure out how to fit in. You know, there was no more... There was no more room for a blue-eyed soul singer, as they used to call people like me. And, you know, I couldn't really fit in. I couldn't be a heavy metal guy, you know, and I really couldn't be a wimpy singer-songwriter like those guys. And so I just was doing survival gigs, you know, with my little band. And one week we were playing out in New Jersey at a Ramada Inn, which is a terrible gig. You're playing to three people during the week. And, you know, they're not paying much attention to you. Well, it was one night I come off stage And the waitress said, there's this fellow over there with his wife, like to a word with you. So I go over to the table, and the guy stands up, and he shakes my hand. He says, my name's L. Russell Brown, and I wrote Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree. He says, you know, he says, Vera, he said, I've been listening to you for years. He said, you're one of the greatest singers I ever heard, and you're a great songwriter, but you never make any money. He says, me, I make a lot of money, and nobody respects me. He said, I got an idea. He says, we ought to write together. I could show you how to make money songwriting, and you could show me how to write songs that get respect. So I started going over to his house, you know, and he was the most energetic guy. And we sometimes write 2-3 songs a day, not all good, but we write a lot. So one day, like a lot of people that do one thing well, he wanted to try something else, and he wanted to be a producer. So he gets a job producing Nancy Sinatra, who hadn't had a hit in years. And he said, listen, I need one more song. I'm recording Nancy this week. I got to go pick up my wife at the beauty parlor. Why don't you start something while I'm gone, and we'll finish it when I get back. I said, great. So I'm thinking, what do I write for Nancy Sinatra, you know? And I said, oh, he has this famous father. And I wrote this line, I love my daddy, but it really don't matter what my daddy might say. You know, lines like that that I thought would fit her. So I had the song finished by the time Larry got back. And he just fell in love with the song. He said, man, this is a number one song if I ever heard one. He said, so he gave it to he. Played it for Nancy, and she hated it. And as it turned out, that was a good thing. But Larry got so mad, he said, you got to do something with this. So my friend Crazy Joe had this little country band up in Connecticut, and he had a girl singer, and we recorded it with her, but she was lazy, and she didn't learn the song properly. So everywhere we took the little tape, they said, love the song, hate the girl. Love the song, hate the girl. So I went through everybody on my list, and the last guy on my list, literally the last guy, he said, love the song, hate the girl, but we're recording Dolly next week. He said, give me the song for her, and I'll guarantee you that it'll be her next single. I said, well, Dolly was hot as hell at that time, and I loved Dolly Parton singing. And she recorded it, and just then, I happened to get an offer to move to Los Angeles to write songs for Warner Brothers. So as I'm driving out here with everything I owned in my car, every 20 minutes I'm hearing my song, Dolly Parton. And I said, my God, I'm back in show business, because I hadn't had a hit in 9 years. And the day I reached L.A., it reached number one. Wow, I'm back in showbiz, you know.
Well, yeah, and you get to L.A. and you get an opportunity to perform at the Troubadour, but you didn't want to do the short sets that people usually did, but they agreed to put you guys on at midnight and say, play as long as you want, and within a matter of weeks, you became the hottest thing in town.
Yeah, that was a very lucky thing. I mean, we really started the band. I had run into an old bass player of mine who had moved out here a couple of years earlier, and he said, what are you doing on the weekends? I said, I don't know anybody. He said, why don't you come out and do a couple of songs with these guys I play with? And so we ended up putting a band together to meet girls, basically. And then we got this, you know, offer to play the Troubadour, as you said, and, you know, within 2 weeks, there was lines around the block. You know, there was, because there was nobody like us. At the time, there was this band that had a song called My Sharona. And so all the record companies were trying to sign four-piece bands with guitars. Mm. And here we were with a nine-piece band with four saxophones and a pedal steel guitar. And, you know, nothing like what record companies wanted. But the people liked us, you know, only the people liked us. And so we played every Monday night at midnight, the worst night of the week, and back in the house for a year straight before we actually got a record deal.
Yeah, and you ended up getting a record deal with the American branch of a Japanese company, Alpha Records, and made what turned out to be the wise decision to record a live album, but not at the Troubadour, over at the Roxy.
Yeah. Yeah, the Roxy was a bigger club, and they were more friendly to record companies than the Troubadour was, shall we say. And we did three nights at the Roxy, recording all three nights, and both video and audio. And because Alpha had, you know, Japanese money, and we were the first act they signed, so we knew we would get a big push from them. And we ended up with a little hit record called I Can Take Care of Myself. And then the follow-up was going to be the song they really believed in, but it was a ballad, so they didn't want to put it out first. And the head of promotion, who was a great promotion man, he got in a fight with the boss and quit. So we had nobody to promote the record, and it only the follow-up record, and it only went up to number 79. And then not long after that, the Japanese pulled the plug and left America.
Well, I remember as a young radio guy playing I Can Take Care of Myself out of the box, as we used to say. And then we were all over at this moment. And I didn't think I knew everything, but I thought I knew a hit when I heard it. And I was stunned when At This Moment didn't become a bigger hit. So my faith was certainly restored, as yours was several years later, when thanks to television, thanks to Family Ties, yeah, At This Moment became the biggest hit of the second half of the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, it really took off, and thanks to television. I had no record deal for the next 5 years, and so I was sort of eking out a living, you know, playing Thug of the Week on television shows. You know, or in movie, you know, when you come from New York, that's what they hire you to play, you know. So that was that, and then one day the golden phone call came. This guy said, we came to the club the other night, and we saw you sing this song. We thought it might be good for an episode of Family Ties. And, you know, I had had songs on TV shows before, and, you know, you make a few bucks, and that's nice. But this time, there was mail, you know, and that was unusual. So I said, well, gee, maybe people like this song. Maybe I'll see if I can get somebody to let me re-record it. And nobody was interested by that time. You know, I was in my late 30s now, and, you know, too old to be a rock and roll star. So, but finally, I was having lunch one day with a friend of mine that owned this company that puts out reissue records called Rhino Records. And, you know, they weren't in the business of putting out contemporary records. But I told him the story about the TV show and everything, and he just put it out to as a favor to me. You know, I don't think he ever thought it was going to sell anything. And then when they used it the following season again, when the girl breaks up with Michael J. Fox, then, you know, NBC got like 6,000 phone calls and letters and telegrams. What's the name of the song? Who's the singer? Where can we buy it? And, you know, then it just took off, just a total grassroots thing with no promotion, because Rhino didn't even know how to promote, and it really happened on its own.
We're talking with Billy Vera on Downtown. There's so much I want to cover. I want to talk about your work with Lou Rawls. We're going to have you come back another time to talk about that. But I also wanted to mention, from your acting career, a film that you did that did not get great reviews at the time, but has become a real cult classic. And when you look at the people involved, no wonder. Can you talk a little bit about the adventures of Buckaroo Banzai?
Sure. I got that film, I think, because they came and saw the band, and they liked the way I ad-libbed on stage, they told me. And they said, you know, we want to put you in this movie. And I read the script and I said, "Wow, this is nuts." Yeah, I'd like something. And the guy was great. He let me do a lot of improvisation, and it was a lot of fun making the movie. You know, and it, as you said, it came out and it didn't do very well at the box office. But you know, about 6 months later, when they put it out on videotape, it went to number one on video sales. And I analyzed it and I said the reason I thought it was because they had made them edit the film, take about a half hour out of the film so that they could fit it more theaters, more times a day in the theaters. And so there was not enough space between the jokes, and people didn't have time to absorb the subtleties of what was going on. But on videotape, they could stop it and say, "What did he say?" And they'd go back. And I think that was the source of the success of the film on video.
I want to mention,
to this day, I get, you know, messages on my website, you know, about Buckaroo Banzai.
I want to talk a little bit about Rip It Up, the specialty record story. That's the label that signed Little Richard, Sam Cooke, and the Soul Stirrer Days, and started by the legendary Art Rupp, who is still alive. Was he 103 now?
102.
Wow.
And he's sharper than you and me put together. he still goes to work 5 days a week running his philanthropic foundation. And, he proofed the book for me. You know, luckily didn't find any mistake.
Well, it's a great story about some tremendous artists and some overlooked artists as well. And I was fascinated to learn a bit more about a friend of our show, Barrett Hansen, best known to the world as Dr. Demento, who had done some invaluable research in helping to put together some of those specialty reissues that you were involved in.
Well, Barry did a reissue. He was hired by the company in the early 70s. And he did a bunch of really good reissues, better than most people were doing at that time. And I'm friendly with him, and you know, I interviewed him for the book. And then I came there in 1989, I think, as a consultant. And then I did my series of, I did about 50. CD reissues and a box set of the specialty catalog.
And you've done great work as a music historian, putting together those reissues. Won a Grammy Award for your liner notes on the reissue of some great Ray Charles music. And then have to mention the new album. We played a little bit of A Lonely Girl Coming In. The new album is called Timeless, just terrific. I love Moon Glows, a little ode to some of that music that you loved as a young guy. That's a terrific song. And I think maybe one of my favorites on the album is A Simple Little Song, where you got some really great help when you're background singers.
Yeah, you know, as we were recording the song, I said, you know, this needs a little something extra. And I thought the children singing the chorus might lend a little bit of innocence that was necessary to the song. So I had done a favor for a friend of mine who teaches at the Academy of Music for the Blind, and I had gone down there and done some music for these kids. And so we got these four little girls, and we brought them in the studio to sing the background on that song. And boy, I'll tell you, it was so sweet and so tender. There wasn't a dry eye in the studio that day, I'll tell you.
Well, it's a wonderful album, Timeless. You got to get the book, Harlem to Hollywood. Watch the documentary as well. Get Rip It Up, the specialty record story, and just get anything you can get your hands on.
All available on Amazon.
There you go. Visit the website as well. And we got to have you back on, Billy. I want you to tell the Ralph Cooper story, because that's just a fantastic story. But it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for making time for us today, and I sure hope we can do it again soon.
I'll be happy to do it anytime you want, my friend. I just want to say one thing. Bangor, Maine, I played there in 1976 during the bicentennial, and I did a spot on a local radio station there, and on the wall I saw a picture of Gabby Hayes. And I said, why Gabby Hayes, you know, in Bangor, Maine? He said, well, Gabby's from there, here.
I didn't even know that.
I said, I didn't know that. I was shocked. You know, I said, I can do a good Gabby Hayes. Hey, Roy, let's go down to the, you know.
See, you've even.
Get off of the pass, Roy.
You've even taught me something about my hometown I didn't know about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wouldn't have known it had I not been at that radio station that day.
That is great. Billy, thank you so much. Great to talk with you. We wish you continued success, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Okay, Rich. Thanks for having me.
That's Billy Vera, the new album, Timeless, and the books, Rip It Up, the specialty record story, and Harlem to Hollywood.